our first story, Behind Mansion Walls.
Hello.
A happy family destroyed by greed.
He loved money. He talked about money. He liked to show off money.
One of the witnesses called him the greediest person he had ever met.
And later, a life of entitlement breeds a master plan for murder.
The whole thing was about the thrill of being about to do a murder. How could people
of such a privileged position do such a thing?
I'm Christopher Mason. Sometimes the self-centered children of wealth grow up to believe they're better than everyone else, including the police. Will they dare try to commit the perfect crime?
Fresno, California, 2 days after Easter Sunday, 1992. Homicide Detective John Souza is called to a bloody crime scene. He's stepping into a complex dance with a killer that will consume his life for the next 3 years.
We looked into the kitchen area, and we seen a young lady laying face down. Then it appeared that she had been shot in the back of the head.
She's quickly identified as Tiffany Ewell, a 24-year-old college student. Her father lies nearby.
The next victim was Dale Ewell. He was lying in the hallway, face down, and also with one gunshot wound to the back of the head.
And further down the hall, Tiffany's mother, Glee.
Glee Ewell was shot 4 times. Twice in the back, one in the heart, and one in the face. She was on her back. She had her car keys in her hand.
Where's she coming or going?
This wasn't, you know, gangsters killing gangsters. This was something that happened in a nice neighborhood. It was something that happened to a nice family.
Even surrounded by affluence, a family can be snuffed out in the safety of their own home. At first glance, this appears to be the work of someone less fortunate, plundering the wealthy. A robbery gone wrong.
Back in the 60s, if you had money in Fresno, you built a big house in the Sunnyside neighborhood. It's discreet and established, but not at all pretentious. Just the way Dale Ewell likes it.
Dale was a very private person. The area, actually, what they lived in was the kind of the older, influential area. But they didn't flaunt their wealth at all.
Dale is an ex-Air Force pilot who makes his million selling small aircraft.
He was a good salesman, and he got very rich doing it. He built that business up very well.
He expands into real estate, buying up hundreds of acres of farmland. There's even change left over for a beach house at Pajaro Dunes in Monterey, California.
He made a lot of money. He's a hard-working guy and respected for that. I guess they always say he was a hard-nosed businessman, but honest.
Dale Ewell's dream is to build a fortune so his children don't have to work as hard as he did. His wife, Glee, supports him all the way. She's the model spouse, throwing herself into charity work.
Glee was very socially conscious. She was involved in a lot of charities, did a lot of that kind of charity work around Fresno. Popular woman.
She took care of her friends, saw to the sick and the needy. Was considered to be a wonderful friend.
For Detective John Souza, One lap of the Ewell's house has him asking questions. Is all this really the work of a burglar? Or is it just meant to look that way?
I've been to a lot of burglary scenes. This had been ransacked. It was just a ransack, not a burglary.
This wasn't a burglary. It was staged to look like a burglary.
A family photo holds a vital clue. Dale and Glee Ewell had two children. Tiffany is lying dead in the hallway. So where on earth is her younger brother, Dana?
It was the whole family except for Dana, the only son, who wasn't there.
Dana Ewell is missing. Is he a hostage or a victim? While police search for him, forensic examiners piece together what happened on that fateful Easter Sunday.
The investigation revealed that Tiffany got shot first. Glee heard her falling to the ground, came to that direction, seen the perpetrator, and took off running. That's when she got shot and killed in the office.
At this moment, Glee's husband Dale still hadn't arrived home.
Dale came at a later time. We speculated anywhere from 15 minutes to a half hour. And so the crook waited for him to get there.
Startled cat burglars don't wait quietly for another person to come home. Hitmen do.
This had been an execution. This was premeditated. This had been designed.
Someone wanted Dale Ewell dead.
Dale Ewell had an unpleasant reputation as a businessman. People were often unhappy after they did business with Dale. He got the better end of almost all the deals he was in. And he might have made somebody angry enough to want to hurt him.
20 years before, he upset a local mafia figure in a business deal.
It's not normal for them to kill women and children unless they're doing what they call their root pull. And a root pull is when everyone gets killed.
A root pull is a possibility. But what about the missing son, Dana Ewell? Dana is the odd one out in the Ewell family. While his father plays down his millions, Dana plays them up.
Dana liked being rich. Dana liked being popular.
He fancied money. What he lived for is wealth and the power and fame that come with it.
A student at Santa Clara University, Dana is known on campus for his luxury cars and imported suits.
Dana carried a briefcase to his classes in college, a nice leather, completely inappropriate briefcase, as everybody else is in sweatshirts and shorts. He wore button-down shirts, you know, Dockers, and carried his briefcase.
So where was Dana while his family was getting shot?
He had gone with his girlfriend, who was the daughter of an FBI agent, to her house for Easter dinner. While his parents and sister were being murdered, he was having dinner at an FBI agent's house, you know, hundreds of miles away. That's a pretty good alibi. It's about as airtight as you can get.
Dana Ewell seems strangely unaffected by the murder of his parents and sister. He says he can't think of anyone who would want them dead. But in the Ewell's blood-stained home, detectives begin to discover that the devil is in the details.
Alarm had been disengaged or was off. There was no forced entry. The house was locked.
Strange. And there's also something odd about the bullets that are used to kill the Ewells.
The thing they noticed quickly was these bullets had deep gouges down the sides.
The serrations on the marks indicated to us that it was a suppressor or silencer used.
It's the preferred tool of a hitman, a silencer, so the neighbors won't hear.
The bullets that were recovered, they were able to determine that they were from the box of bullets in the house.
Dale Ewell and his family were killed with Dale's own bullets. But Dale's gun doesn't have a silencer.
So that means someone came with a gun with a silencer and appeared to maybe use the bullets from the family to kill him with. You don't bring a gun to a gunfight or execution with no bullets in it, unless you know there's bullets there to get.
And the execution theory begs one more question.
Someone was here waiting for them, the family, to show up. So how did they know when they were going to show up unless they had inside information?
This family hitman is clearly someone who knew too much. The mounting evidence keeps driving home one confounding point. It's an inside job. But who could be the insider?
He went transparent, went just white. And it says, oh, and closed the door.
Easter Sunday, 1992.
It was an execution.
The Ewell family returned from their beach house.
I'm just gonna make a sandwich, I'm starving.
One gunshot went to the back of the head.
One by one.
Glee had seen her daughter get shot.
They are executed.
They wanted the whole family killed.
By a killer who seemed to know just when they were coming home.
The purpose of the killing was not some random act, but it was an intentional killing of the entire family.
A cold-blooded hit on a wealthy family, carefully planned with inside knowledge. Why? Is it a grudge, a mob hit, or simple greed?
Dale Ewell is said to have had a tangle with a local gangster.
I was familiar with this alleged mafia figure. He's considered a hothead. He would not have waited 21 years to kill the family. And then, secondly, he wouldn't kill the family. His anger was on Dale Ewell, not Glee or Tiffany.
This time around, the mob's hands are clean. But Detective John Souza has his eyes and ears wide open. The day after his entire family has been discovered shot dead, 19-year-old Dana Ewell returns to his family's home.
Who's that? That was your mother.
And so we go through this house, and there's several things that are just very strange.
What are they doing?
The first thing that turned their heads his way was when Dana walked through his mother's blood.
You can't go in there.
Rather than step over it like almost any other victim would do.
We thought that was unbelievable.
Hey, where's he going with that? I want an itemized list of everything that's taken from this house.
No tears.
I'll see what I can do.
No emotion at all. Just like it's all, everything is matter of fact.
Now suspicious, detectives comb through Dana's past. They discover a young man whose heart only beats for one love. Money.
He wanted to be successful. He loved money. He talked about money. He liked to show off money.
Marcy Bonilla dated Dana in junior high.
He would lie when he could get away with it. He would manipulate. He just wasn't a very trustworthy person.
Marcy remembers Dana's strange fixation with his wealthy father.
It seemed like he would wear his dad's clothes. The pants he always wore were so big on him. One day he wore his dad's Rolex to school that would just hang from his arm. It was like he was trying to be his dad, I guess. Fill his dad's shoes.
Once in college, this leopard does not change his spots.
While he was in college, he got featured in one of the local papers as a self-made millionaire.
Check this.
you know, that he sold airplanes and he built this business up and made millions of dollars and that he was doing stock deals between classes while he was in high school. It was all a lie.
Wait, you made this up?
Hey, jump in. Give you a lift to class.
Okay.
I'll see you guys later.
He had claimed all these things that his father had done. He was sort of taking his father's legacy, if you will.
Hey, Junior, you ready, old man?
Dana wants to be just like his father. Not because he loves the man, but because he loves his money.
They asked themselves, why would he do this? What was the motive? The family's wealth was a strong motivation. I mean, there was millions of dollars in the family's estate that would go to Dana.
Is $8 million motive enough for murder? And if it is, how was Dana able to plan the perfect crime? Well, I've observed one thing about the wealthy. They often rely on hired help.
Well, I want an itemized list of everything that's taken from this house.
Once the detectives started looking at Dana as a possibility because of the way he had acted, because of some of the things he had said, they obviously knew they needed to find the actual gunman because Dana's alibi was airtight. So they went to Dana's college and started asking around.
At college, Dana plays the rich big shot, which makes one choice of friend very curious.
Dana being the $200 shirt and $100 tie guy, he's running around a guy cut off Levi's and just a slob.
This slob is named Joel Radovich.
When I got a hold of him, I said, well, I understand that, you know, you were good friends with Dana, and, you know, his parents got killed. And I said, yeah, I heard that. And he goes, are you going to arrest me?
That makes detectives suspicious. So then they started looking at how can we connect Dana to Joel, Joel to the murder.
So begins a game of cat and mouse that drags on 3 long years. Dana Ewell hadn't counted on a determined detective who just will not go away.
Dana made numerous comments to people that we would never solve this case because we're not smart enough, and that the only reason we were cops because we weren't smart enough to get any other job.
If John Souza wasn't already as motivated a detective as ever lived, them dishing him ramped it up. He was more determined than before to see this to its conclusion. This was boy against man.
John Souza is like a dog with a bone, and Dana's friend Joel is looking more and more like the hitman. His alibi for the night of the murders is weak.
That's the silencer right there.
He's ordered books about building pistol silencers, and he and Dana act like people with something big to hide.
Dana was a person that you couldn't follow because he was looking at the mirror all the time.
They were communicating in ways that drug dealers did back in the early 90s. They both had pagers, and they would page each other, then go to a payphone and call back.
Those tactics may dodge a modern wiretap, but they're no match for old-fashioned eavesdropping.
They'd have an agent go up and use the phone next to him, pretend to carry on a conversation, try and hear, you know, Dana or Joel talking.
Finally, a breakthrough. Detectives discover that unemployed Joel has spent over $30,000 on flying lessons.
Dana was paying for them, and that was a significant amount of money, and we needed a money connection.
Is this payment for murder? It's time to turn the screws.
They told Dana they believed Joel had done it. They wanted to see Dana's reaction.
And he went transparent. Went just white. And it says, oh, and closed the door.
It isn't long before Dana and Joel hit the payphones again. As Joel starts his call, an undercover cop listens in.
I'm starting to worry about this a little bit.
Now they're starting to talk about
the murder.
I need to know if I can get charged in this whole three-shirt deal.
Don't talk to anybody.
And we obviously conclude that being the three bodies.
Just lay low.
There's one missing piece in this puzzle.
Just calm down, all right?
The murder weapon.
Over time, the detectives found other people in Joel's circle of friends.
Detectives discover that Joel Radovich had an illegal lockpick sent to a friend's house. They wonder what other illegal connections Joel has with his friend.
I felt if he was shown that we had an arrest warrant for three counts of murder, he would come clean.
Has Joel's friend owned a gun before? He has. A 9mm pistol, just like the one that was used on the Ewells. He sold it to Joel Radovich. And after the murder, Joel gave him a confession.
He eventually said that Joel had confessed. He told him he had committed these murders.
Retrieved the barrel, cleaned it up, and shot it, and positively identified it as a murder weapon.
Dana Ewell is arrested amid the wreckage of his perfect crime. After years of tenacious police work, the evidence is overwhelming. And a stubborn underdog cop handcuffs a guilty man.
Dana's position to this day is that he's innocent. That there's nothing for him to be remorseful about in the murder of his parents.
What he did was obviously very evil. And the one that made me madder than the fact he killed his parents, he killed his sister. So he wouldn't have to split the $8 million. That's the only reason she died. That was, to me, was evil. That's strictly about money, period.
It was the height of arrogance. I'm smarter than those working class cops. I'm Dana Ewell. Catch me if you can. But he was a rich little boy playing a man's game. Now Dana and Joel are serving life sentences with no parole. They will die in prison.
Up next, behind mansion walls.
It was just a horrific murder.
Rich kids look for new kicks.
The crime was every parent's worst nightmare.
And play a deadly game.
I think they principally did it for thrills.
Chicago, the roaring 20s. America's barons of enterprise are making money hand over fist. It's a happy time for the city's elite. But on May 22nd, 1924, millionaire businessman Jacob Franks fights a sick feeling in his stomach.
Dear sir, as you no doubt know by this time, your son has been kidnapped.
His 14-year-old son, Bobby, has disappeared while walking home.
He is at present, well and safe.
Now, there's a ransom demand for $10,000. Or else.
Should you, however, disobey any of our instructions, his death will be the penalty.
$10,000 then would be the equivalent of over $100,000 today. While most parents will pay anything to save their child's life, wealthy parents hold much larger checkbooks. And the Franks would seem to have no trouble ponying up.
Young Bobby Franks had the world at his feet. After a school day at Harvard Boys, he'd walk home to the family mansion in elite Kenwood. His father is a retired industrialist and president of the Chicago Public Library. The Franks want for nothing. But status and wealth can't stop heartbreak or murder.
The crime was every parent's worst nightmare.
Just hours after the Franks received the ransom note, Bobby's dead body is found in Wolf Lake, a remote parkland outside the city. He is beaten and horribly disfigured, as if acid has eaten his flesh.
What could horrify parents more than the thought that their child, simply walking home from school, could be picked up and murdered?
The Franks are devastated and confused. First, the ransom note. Then, before they have a chance to respond, their son turns up dead.
To investigators, it just doesn't add up. Why would a kidnapper kill a hostage before they get their hands on the money? Who could possibly be behind this?
There is one clue at the murder scene, a pair of eyeglasses. They don't belong to the boy, so whose are they? Then there's Wolf Lake itself. Who would know it well enough to hide a body here? Police discover that it's a haven for bird watchers.
The thing about bird watching, it is a genteel preoccupation of the leisure class going back centuries.
One particular bird watcher catches their attention. Another rich teenager, Nathan Leopold.
Nathan Leopold came out of one of the most wealthy families in all of Chicago.
His father owns the biggest paper mill in Illinois. At 19, Nathan is heir to a grand fortune. So the last thing he needs is ransom money. But rich victims demand quick justice. So police explore all avenues, no matter how unlikely. They interview the wealthy heir.
On the 21st, I was with Richard Loeb and a couple of girls. We went for a country drive.
As expected, Leopold has a convincing alibi for the day of the murder. Like so many rich kids, he was wooing girls in his flashy car. The girls were strangers, he tells police. Conveniently, he can't remember their names. But he does identify his good pal and driving buddy, Richard Loeb. Another teen aristocrat with impeccable credentials.
Richard Loeb is a popular, cocky, good-looking guy, a guy who liked to hang out with girls, very privileged kid, and probably spoiled because of the wealth the family had.
Richard's father is a vice president of American retail icon Sears Roebuck. Two rich kids picking up girls, nothing unusual there. It seems like a dead end.
But behind mansion walls, what is murder to you and me can be just a parlor game. The cops have no idea they're being played for fools, that a killer is toying with them.
In 1920s Chicago, gangsters aren't the only residents with a taste for murder.
They bludgeon to death a 14-year-old Bobby Franks.
They take out hydrochloric acid and pour it over Bobby Franks in the hopes of disguising the body.
It was just a horrific murder.
For months before the slaying of a young aristocrat, two rich teenagers are plotting.
The two of them are said to have had a sexual relationship with one another.
I don't get the same thrill out of this as you, Dickie.
But sex is just one secret Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb are keeping to themselves.
Richard Loeb would promise to provide sex for Nathan Leopold in return for Nathan Leopold's agreeing to participate in a certain number of crime adventures with Richard Loeb.
They're bourgeois criminals, using their superior class and education to outsmart the law.
Leopold, he had a measured IQ of 200. He graduated from the University of Chicago at 18.
Richard Loeb has a passion for crime novels.
Richard Loeb had a fantasy life. He really liked detective stories. He was pushed into the classics, but his real love was the detective stories.
This doesn't excite me. It excites you. Well, I know what excites you.
I've seen it often. When wealth gives you any plaything at the snap of your fingers, everyday life seems dull as dishwater. Excitement comes when you start playing games with society's taboos.
The boys had committed increasingly ambitious crimes.
What are you proposing?
Arson, car theft. But yet they hadn't committed a crime that really they thought matched their own intellectual potential.
Loeb's passion for crime stories incites them further.
They wanted to commit the perfect crime, a crime that would be an elaborate crime, a crime that would make people say, wow, what a crime.
And such others.
Should you, however,
disobey any of our instructions,
even slightly.
So the finest education money can buy is perverted into kidnap and murder. For an amusing goal, committing the perfect crime.
I think every once in a while, the wrong people meet. And I think that's true for Leopold and Loeb.
In the days following little Bobby's death, Leopold and Loeb's game is in full play.
He was arrogant, selfish.
Part of the fun is to be involved in the investigation. Loeb offers his opinions to journalists.
I mean, if I was going to murder anybody, he's exactly the kind of cocky son of a bitch that I would pick.
I think Loeb inserted himself into the story by talking to journalists, both as a way to stay close to it and try to get information from them.
But these whiz kids aren't quite as smart as they think. First, the body is found before they have a chance to collect the ransom.
The boys were convinced that it would take weeks to find the body. It will have deteriorated to the point where identification would be very difficult. As it turns out, however, the body is found the very next morning.
And one of them has made a schoolboy error. Police have been investigating those glasses.
The lenses apparently were unremarkable. The frames were not remarkable, but the hinges on the frames were remarkable.
Old-fashioned detective work brings a breakthrough. Only three people in Chicago were prescribed glasses with such an extravagant hinge. And one of them is none other than Nathan Leopold.
Did you lose your glasses?
No.
Have you got them?
Not on me.
For that to be discovered so quickly at a time when there's, of course, no computer, no DNA, none of the other crime methods was really extraordinary.
Do you know how busy I am? I've got an appointment at 3 o'clock.
As suspicion falls on Leopold and his friend Loeb, police challenge their alibi. Perhaps they weren't picking up girls the day of the murder, but their victim.
The turning point in the investigation probably was when the Nathan Leopold family chauffeur came forward to police. He could prove that Nathan Leopold's car was sitting in his garage the entire day in which the crime was committed.
Far from exonerating young Leopold, the chauffeur helps tighten a noose around his neck.
After you.
Thank you.
Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb were telling investigators that they were picking up girls in Nathan Leopold's car cannot be true. They were lying. Their alibi is not accurate.
It's no good holding out, Richard. Leopold is the owner of those glasses. Your alibi has fallen apart.
Experiencing the kind of interrogation he relished as an avid crime reader, Richard Loeb crashes to earth. He realizes they haven't pulled off the perfect crime.
Come clean.
In fact, one imperfection follows the next. Typewriters are like people. They leave fingerprints with every letter. The ransom note was pecked on an Underwood machine, just like Nathan Leopold's.
This is too new.
The glasses, the false alibi, the ransom note trace. Who's smartest now?
They thought the police were dullards, not in their league. Leopold and Loeb made their own rules and their own morality. Now the cops look like they're winning this game. But when it comes to trial, never underestimate the power of money.
Before the term thrill kill is coined, there's Leopold and Loeb. Two wealthy teenagers who want to commit the perfect crime for fun. But they miscalculate so badly, they're arrested within days.
This is out of control. Do you even know who I am?
And now, they're spilling their sordid story.
Okay, I'll tell you all.
Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb don't just settle for hunting fox, quail, or pheasant like their wealthy friends. These two young men, heirs to millions of dollars, hunt an innocent child.
Leopold and Loeb wait in a rented vehicle as 14-year-old Bobby Franks walks home.
The victim was chosen somewhat randomly. They circled around, looked for people coming out of the Harvard School for Boys, and Bobby Franks was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
They know Bobby from their tennis club.
Hey, Bobby, come on, I'll give you a lift. Hop in.
Oh, I can walk. I live just up the road.
I think the whole thing was about the thrill of plotting a kidnapping and murder. The thrill of actually luring Bobby into the car.
Come on, I want to talk to you about a tennis racket you had yesterday.
The thrill of being about to do a murder.
Once Bobby Franks is in the car, it's not long before the chisel comes out. Richard Loeb leans over that front seat and begins bashing the skull of young Bobby Franks.
Come in, arrogant little son of a bitch!
He lives for a while, longer than the boys expected him to. Eventually, Loeb grabs cloth, sticks it in the mouth of Bobby Franks, and he dies, either of suffocation or blows.
The clumsy murder is just the start to this imperfect crime.
The fact that these two young men were so very smart didn't really give them much of an advantage. I've seen dumb criminals who made fewer mistakes than these two kids.
They drag the body out of the car, bring it over to a drainage ditch. Nathan Leopold has to take off his jacket, which happens to have a pair of glasses in it at that time. They take out a bottle of hydrochloric acid and pour it over Bobby Franks's face and genitals, in the hopes of disguising the body.
Hey,
heavy son of a bitch.
So Bobby Franks' naked, acid-ridden body is stuffed into that culvert and left.
Just let me do it.
They wanted Chicago to recognize that the perfect crime had been committed, and they wanted to sit back and watch as people tried to figure out how this crime was committed and who committed it. They wanted to sit back and laugh at the futility of the investigators.
Now is the 08 trial. No one is laughing. They've completely tarnished the reputation of Chicago's elite.
The city is horrified. How could people of such a privileged position do such a thing? What's wrong with these families? What's wrong with our society that such a thing could happen?
Were these children of the rich so depraved they could resort to murder for entertainment? People are horrified. They demand justice, the death penalty. In Chicago, it is deemed the trial of the century.
The boys have the best defense money can buy, the famous attorney, Clarence Darrow.
He was very much against the capital punishment and wanted to use this case as a way of avoiding capital punishment. And at the time, this was easily as big as the O.J. Simpson case.
Darrow convinces Leopold and Loeb to plead guilty, so they avoid a jury trial. Next, he tries to convince the judge to spare their lives.
And I'm damned if I'm gonna let it happen now.
He views crime as always having a cause, and that cause is always rooted in the environment in which that criminal grows up. He blamed their wealth, he blamed their idleness, he blamed detective stories. He blamed anyone but the boys themselves.
The innovative defense doesn't work. Convicted of murder, the pair's lives are spared, but only because the judge thinks it useful to study the killers. Sentenced to life plus 99 years, Leopold and Loeb are sent to the same prison and continue their relationship until Loeb is slashed to death by another inmate.
Nathan Leopold went on to use his intelligence for good, fighting to improve the prison education system. He so impressed his captors that after 34 years, they let him free.
Leopold moved to Puerto Rico and lived quietly until 1971, when he died of a heart attack at age 66. Bobby Franks would have been 61.
Born into a world of money, these children grew into deadly offspring. Dana Ewell was possessed by an ice-cold greed. For Leopold and Loeb, it was all about ego. These sons of wealth played life as a lethal game, a quest to commit the perfect crime. Till next we meet, behind mansion walls, I'm Christopher Mason.